Senator Agriculture and Veterans Committee will come to order. Moved a little bit around on the calendar. Senator Dibble, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have the A1 amendment.
We can't move it until we have a quorum. We can talk about it.
While that's coming around, Mr. Chair, I'll just explain the bill very quickly.
We can talk about it, but we can't process it because we don't have enough.
Okay.
But they'll be coming quickly. You
right.
can still go through this.
Well, when they hear this bill is being talked about, they'll come running. So, Mr. Chair, cocoa bean shell mulch is a product that has recently become more popular. It used to be a kind of a specialty item that gardeners used. It was really expensive, came in small bags, and they'd use it only around their rose bushes or something. But it recently has become very popular, very inexpensive. You can get big bags of it at Home Depot and other places. And so and it's a very desirable mulch to use in your garden. It smells really good. It smells like chocolate. And it's got a nice nice appearance and a nice texture. And so a lot more folks are using it now as it's become much more popular. Unfortunately, cocoa bean shell mulch contains the same element as chocolate that's really bad for dogs and cats, theobromine. And because it smells like chocolate, smells like food, some dogs are attracted to it and they eat it. Of course, they can suffer extremely serious health consequences up to and including death. And in fact, the reason I became aware of that fact is because one of my constituents contacted me, or a couple of my constituents contacted me a couple of years ago now and told me about their dog, Moose, who ate some of this cocoa bean mulch and died as a result. Coming around, you see the letter coming around to you? That's a letter. Oh, I guess you saw the amendment coming around, but now this letter is coming around. That's a letter from their veterinarian who kind of describes the circumstances around Moose's death. I hopped online and you know, to verify that this, in fact, was a serious issue. And it is a real concern. So what my bill proposes to do, Mr. Chair, is simply not to ban the sale of cocoa bean mulch. I think that would be maybe a little bit of a strong act to take, but just to make folks aware that when they're buying cocoa bean mulch, they might want to think about the fact that, you know, if they have dogs, they might want to keep their dogs away from it or consider another product. And so my bill simply proposes to ask retailers to put up a sign. It would look a lot like this. This is the 36-point typeface font, just to say, just be aware that this might be bad for your dog. With that, Mr. Chair, we have Terry Hall here, who was the owner of Moose, who can tell you a little bit about what happened in their family.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and distinguished members. I come to you today as a former Air Force military working dog handler. I protected my country with the Secret Service and then grown to love dogs as more than just a pet, but as a vital part of a family and a community. On the day in question when our dog was poisoned by this particular product, it was no day that was any different than any other. My wife and I were on the St. Croix River. We had gone out with family to enjoy the day. The only indication that we had that anything out of the ordinary was wrong with our dog was that he didn't come right back when I called him, which was incredibly rare for this particular animal. While I was standing in the water, I turned around almost simultaneously to see my wife staring in the water and to see only a brown floating shadow. I immediately ran over, grabbed Moose, who you'll see in the photographs here, and began to assess him with canine first aid. I was unable to find any puncture holes. No other boats were around him. And I immediately began canine CPR as we speeded down the St. Croix River trying to get back to the marina. I have never felt the earth shake and move as bad as it did by the heartbreak and the tears of my wife, who would love to be here today, but still is very heartbroken by this particular tragedy. So I'm here representing her and our new baby girl, who won't have the opportunity to enjoy this wonderful pet. Upon being on the phone with 911 and determining that Moose had passed, I had the very unfortunate experience of telling my wife that he was dead. We were both in shock. We couldn't put two and two together to find out what was wrong. So we instantly went to the University of Minnesota, where we brought Moose in. A necropsy, which is equivalent to an autopsy for a canine, was performed. At that time, it was determined that Moose had ingested cocoa shell mulch. Now, to add insult to injury in this particular case, I was the one that purchased the cocoa shell mulch. When I purchased that mulch, on the outside of that package, it said no pesticides, organic, all things that would indicate to a normal consumer that this product was safe. However, that particular product had not gone through the third stage of processing where the cocoa product, theobromine, is baked out of it. That is a more expensive process for these companies to process this particular product with. So it was determined that the cause of death was from theobromine. Now, to put this in some perspective, it's equivalent to if I were to give you a large dose of speed and then ask you to run Grandma's Marathon. No one would know anything was wrong with you until your heart exploded. So I have the toxicology report here. This was a perfectly healthy 3-year-old chocolate lab who had been meticulously cared for. So when this happened, we contacted the company that produces this product. They are aware that this product actually has this potential harm. We then started to walk around our neighborhood in southwest Minneapolis, only to find that 10 of our neighbors within no more than a block's distance from our home also have this in their yard. When we knocked on their doors to speak to them, they had no idea that this product did cause this particular result. We contacted Humane Society. We contacted local news and became a national story, pushed up from the New York desk of ABC News, also covered here on WCCO. The response from others who had experienced this was pretty staggering, so much so that we contacted Senator Dibble's office and thought, out of our pain and tragedy of this very unfortunate incident, that we could help other people by no more than creating awareness about this particular product. So I plead to you as fellow citizens, as a veteran of our armed services, and as a very vibrant member of my community, to bring this awareness to folks so that we can prevent these types of tragedies from happening in the future. This is certainly something that is completely avoidable.
Thank you for your time today.
Let the record show that a quorum is present. Senator Kubley moves the author A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 So adopted. Now your bill is in order, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the A1 amendment members and Mr. Chair simply recognizes that some companies do process this cocoa bean shell mulch to get the theobromine out of it, and so we're only talking about the unprocessed cocoa bean shell mulch. Mr. Chair, I have Mike Murphy here. He's a doctor of veterinary medicine at the University of Minnesota, and he's a toxicologist. He can share a little bit more information about the toxic effects of theobromine.
Yes, go
ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, you know, you talked to me about this bill, and you know, and I'll support what you want to do with this. But you know, as I listen to the testifier, why aren't we just banning this unprocessed cocoa bean mulch? I still can't get my head quite around that, and I mean, the other thing, what if some young child was to eat this?
Senator Dibble.
Second question first. I think the discomfort of having cocoa bean shells inside, you know, it'd be the same effect as eating chocolate. So it's not harmful to people.
Just to animals.
Right, just to dogs and cats. You know, that's why we don't give our dogs chocolate at Christmas. Everyone knows that's a bad idea because it will kill them. So we hope our kids aren't eating cocoa beans, but they'll have a couple of uncomfortable days if they eat them.
Well,
but as far as banning it outright, I guess, you know, that's just kind of the avenue I decided to pursue, you know, just to create some more consumer awareness and maybe not to pull opposition out of the woodwork. I mean, it's just kind of a judgment call I made, I guess. If we want to do that, I guess we can try to do that. See who shows up.
Yeah. If I may, Mr. Chair, after the unfortunate incident, we sought out legal counsel to take up this cause on a national level. One of the largest producers of this product is Hershey's. This is a byproduct that they use to sell off to make profit from processing cocoa. And we were told at that time that we would need a substantial amount of money to make this case to get this particular product banned. That being the case, and not having those resources to do that, we have turned to the law to hopefully bring awareness to it. If this committee so did see fit to ban that, my wife and I would support that even more than the bill that you have before you.
You have another witness, Senator?
Dr. Michael Murphy from the University of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mike Murphy. I'm a toxicologist at the College of Vet Medicine, University of Minnesota. My position is split for the last 22 years between the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, where the dog went for necropsy, and the college teaching veterinary students toxicology. So I really only have a very brief statement, and then I thought if there were any questions, I could respond. My understanding is that the concentration of theobromin in the mulch of the cocoa beans after the cocoa is processed can be quite variable. If it were about 1% theobromin in the mulch, then a 55-pound dog would need to ingest about 9 ounces of mulch, which is represented by these bags, and roughly speaking, and that based on the theobromin content in cocoa or baking chocolate, that would be about 8 ounces, which is represented by this little box of baking cocoa. The concentration of theobromin, has been alluded to already, is quite variable depending on how the mulch is processed. And so it may be around 1% or it may be substantially less than that. And being a toxicologist, then the dose would vary, of course, a great deal depending on whether the theobromin was still present in the mulch or not. And with that, be pleased to answer any questions that you might have.
Senator Dale.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Murphy, do you know if most of the mulch is processed or washed or baked or whatever it has to be done to reduce the toxicity?
I did contact a couple of the distributors of the mulch, the National Cocoa Shell Incorporated and La Boudé Group. And they received the shells from the chocolate manufacturer, and they did not do the processing there. They received it from whoever is processing the chocolate. So I wasn't able to determine as of today where that additional process step is taking place. My understanding is that some chocolate producers do, because it's in their financial best interest to keep as much cocoa from the cocoa bean as they can, but perhaps not everyone does, and I think that's been alluded to already.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm a co-author on this bill with Senator Dibble. At least I was. I got my name off the bill partway through when I started doing some research on it, and then I decided that Senator Dibble did have a good point, and I never did get my name back on the bill, although I see it's listed here. So I think with the amendment that Senator Dibble has, it's a good bill. And the key thing with the amendment, I think, is are the words down on line 1.17. We've added the words after theobromine to a non-toxic level. Because without those words on there, it would require that the toxin be completely removed from the cocoa bean mulch. And that's not going to be possible. So we reduce it down to a non-toxic level, and if that's the case, we don't have to put up the sign.
Sure.
Mayor Dibble.
I have a better answer for Senator Skoy. The benefit of some thought. The other thing that might happen as a result of greater consumer awareness is more of these cocoa bean shell mulch suppliers perhaps will move in that direction, and so it'll create a wider acceptance in the market of a safer product.
Senator Skoy?
Well, Mr. Chair, when it's timely, I'll move Senate File number 122 be recommended to pass and referred to wherever it needs to go. But if there's questions, I can hold.
Senator Engelbretson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've just got one question of the doctor. What's the end dote here? I mean, if you were to be able to find out in time, you may have said that. How do you bring the dog out of it?
Specific antidote. Reportedly, if their cardiac problems has been mentioned, then they're treated for the cardiac arrhythmias, if their seizures, an anti-seizuring medication, and they can do to get it out of their stomach. But there isn't a specific antidote that would immediately correct it.
Senator Deal.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Murphy, in your 20 years as a veterinary toxicologist or longer, how many cases of this have you seen?
From the cocoa bean mulch that I'm aware of, maybe two or three.
And how many cases from eating chocolate?
From eating the chocolate, I can't give you a firm number, but it's substantially more than that. Maybe an order of magnitude more than that.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble, I'm glad you're bringing this bill forward. I have a dog, I think, the world of a big police dog. And I buy all kinds of plants, all kinds of flowers. I never heard of this before. If you wouldn't have brought it up, I think a lot of people, and if you're worrying about what it's going to do, people find out this kills pets. There won't be such a thing as that mulch. You just watch that go down. Who's going to take a chance on it? What if your little kids crawl across the room and they chew on anything? That's the way life is. Senator Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to clarify, just to double-check, that it's only dogs, isn't it, that's affected by this? This is not a deadly product for children or for cats, because cats are going to be out in the garden. I have cocoa bean mulch in my garden. And it smells great. But I also don't have a dog. And I do know that dogs aren't supposed to eat chocolate, but I don't think I would have thought about the mulch if I did have a dog out in the backyard. So it's an interesting thing to be talking about. But to Senator Dill's question perhaps earlier about how many dogs die in the state every year from eating chocolate at home, I think that would be an interesting thing to run down, because I don't know what sort of public education there is out there except dog owner to dog owner about don't feed your dog chocolate. But this is an interesting thing. And the dog, it's outdoors as opposed to an indoor product, you know, like the chocolate that's indoors. It's a more controlled environment. But I just want to clarify, Mr. Chair, it's not toxic to children or people at all. It's only dogs that it affects.
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion that Senate File 122 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Industry, Business, and Jobs Committee.
Senator Skoy, you should probably put as amended.
As amended.
And be referred to Business, Industry, and Jobs.
Yep.
We understand the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Next on the list is Senate File 236, Carlson.
Good
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jim.
Senator Jim Carlson, and I'm here for Senate File 236, which is the Minnesota Medal of Honor Day. And what this does is it puts in statute a Medal of Honor Day, which is designated as March 25th, which is 2 weeks from tomorrow. And it matches the federal day that was passed in 2007 and signed into law on March 25th, 2007. I have with me Sir David Hammer, who brought the bill, brought the idea to me, and we've been working on the bill together, and he can provide some testimony or answer any questions that you may have.
My name is David Hammer. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify on the creation of a Minnesota Medal of Honor Day. I'm a veteran of the U.S. Army and a retiree of the U.S. Air Force Reserves. The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in action against an enemy force, which can be bestowed upon an individual serving in the United States Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, and Coast Guard. To receive this rare honor, the President of the United States must approve it after a long and rigorous consideration process, and then the President presents it personally to the recipient in the name of the Congress. Since the birth of our nation, over 40 million Americans have faced combat, yet only 3,448 have received our nation's highest honor for combat. Of those 3,448, only 55 are credited to Minnesota. Quite often the word winner is incorrectly used to describe the Medal of Honor recipient. The medal isn't bestowed for running a foot race or being number one in a contest. In fact, most are given to the next of kin because the Medal of Honor recipient has given his life to protect others. Currently, there are 98 Medal of Honor recipients and only two from Minnesota. The first is Mike Colaleo, U.S. Army, from Hibbing, who earned his medal during World War II and resides in Duluth. The second is Leo Thorsness, U.S. Air Force, from Walnut Grove, Minnesota, who earned his medal during Vietnam and now resides out of state. The list of Medal of Honor recipients also includes a rare peacetime award to Charles A. Lindbergh, Army Air Corps, for his flight across the Atlantic. The list of Minnesotans also includes the person that Fleming Field at South St. Paul is named for, Richard Fleming, U.S. Marines from World War II. President Abraham Lincoln created the Medal of Honor, and it was first presented on March 25, 1863. As Senator Carlson said, the U.S. House and Senate unanimously passed the National Medal of Honor Day on March 25, 2007. With a National Medal of Honor Day, why do we need a Minnesota Medal of Honor Day? I feel the young today need heroes. We've seen sports stars and celebrities that our young look up to become questionable role models in these recent years. Recognizing our Medal of Honor recipients as heroes shows that these individuals that sacrifice others over themselves are important. It is the ideals of courage, sacrifice, integrity, patriotism, commitment, and citizenship that surround the Medal of Honor. This time I'd like to read one of the Medal of Honor citations from a Minnesota resident. This one is from Richard Sorensen from Anoka, who served in the U.S. Marines during World War II. The citation reads, "For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity, at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty while serving in an assault battalion attached to the 4th Marine Division during the Battle of Namur Island, Hualajin Atoll, Marshall Islands on 1-2 February 1944. Putting up a brave defense against a particularly violent counterattack by the enemy during invasion operations, Private Sorensen and five of the Marines occupying a shell hole were endangered by a Japanese grenade thrown into their midst. Unhesitantly, and with complete disregard for his own safety, Private Sorensen hurled himself upon the deadly weapon, heroically taking the full impact of the explosion. As a result of his gallant action, he was severely wounded, but the lives of his comrades were saved. His great personal valor and exceptional spirit of self-sacrifice in the face of this almost certain death were in keeping with the highest traditions of the U.S. Naval Service." That ends the end of his citation. While I served in the military, I wasn't ever in a combat situation. I don't have a clue what would prompt someone to make a decision to risk certain death by covering a grenade with his body. I do understand the value of it from my military experience, but I don't know how a person comes to that conclusion. As part of the National Medal of Honor Day, a new Above and Beyond Citizen Award was created. Nominations of Americans have shown that have shown service before self were presented to the Living Medal of Honor recipients who in turn vote for these individuals that best fit the category. The first awards were presented March 25, 2008. One of the recipients was Matthew Miller from Fridley. Matthew went above and beyond as he rescued victims from the I-35W bridge collapse. While Matthew didn't face combat, I expect he faced many of the same ideals found in a Medal of Honor recipient. It is the hopes of the Living Medal of Honor recipients that the above and above and beyond Citizen Award will help our young understand the values of the Medal of Honor. It is a way for the Living Medal of Honor recipients to give something back to this nation that has bestowed upon them. On March 25th this year, the Minnesota Commander's Task Force will dedicate a plaque to the Minnesota Medal of Honor recipients. The plaque was paid for the Commander's Task Force and will be located in the Court of Honor on the Capitol Mall. That is surrounding the World War II Memorial in front of the Veterans Service Building. The Minnesota Commander's Task Force consists of the American ex-POW, American Legion, AMVETS, Disabled American Veterans, Jewish War Veterans, Marine Corps League, Military Order of the Purple Heart, Veterans of Foreign Wars, and Vietnam Veterans of America. At a time when we face many uncertainties in the world, honoring our Medal of Honor recipients and showing our Minnesota youth that the values surrounding the Medal of Honor will be positive. If it makes one person read about the ideals and values surrounding the Minnesota Medal of Honor Day, it will be good. Additionally, we must honor our deceased Medal of Honor recipients, and we must do it now before the living Minnesota Medal of Honor recipients have passed away. Thank you.
Any questions from the members? Mr. Engelbretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the testimony. Does anybody know why this was not done in the United States until 2007? Have it's been tried before, or any reason why, or any history on that, Senator, at all?
None that I'm aware of, Mr. Chair and Senator Engelbretson. I have no information on that. It was evidently started in the House of Representatives. And if I might, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hammer, tell just a little bit of an anecdote. My mother came from a large family. She had 10 brothers. All have passed away, but, it was two. Yesterday, another one passed away. He's the veteran in the family that fought in the Pacific, and he was standing next to me up here when I read names last year for the Veterans Memorial. And he told me for the first time a lot of things that he did in the Pacific. And one of the things that he actually showed me, the picture of himself standing on ground zero a month after the bomb had hit in Hiroshima. But these folks need to be remembered as much as possible when they're alive. Because when they passed away, we don't have them anymore to remind us of what they've done. So, thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Any further discussion? Not. Senator Forby moves that Senate File 236 be recommended to pass, and I'm going to send it to the consent calendar. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So, you're on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Senator Sarkis.
Number 364, drainage system provisions. Senator Sparks, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sparks, and I'm pleased to be here today to discuss Senate File 364 with you and the other members of the committee. As Minnesota puts an increasing focus on water quality, restoration, and protection, drainage management is increasingly important. The Drainage Work Group has been able to bring many different stakeholder perspectives together to identify consensus recommendations for improved drainage management. Senate File 364 is another opportunity to implement the cooperative work of the Drainage Work Group to advance drainage management in Minnesota. I would like to thank members for your past support. Back in 2007, we passed the first set of Drainage Work Group consensus recommendations, and this is a further piece of legislation that will go in that area. With me today, Mr. Chair, I have Mr. Kane, the Chief Engineer with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, and he will be glad to walk you through the bill.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Al Kane. I serve as Chief Engineer for the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. I also serve as the facilitator for the Drainage Work Group. And Mr. Chairman, members, I'd like to review with you quickly two items that are in your packets. The first is a copy of a page from the Bowser website with drainage on the top. And you'll see then on that page the heading Drainage Work Group. And there's also then in that table beneath there a list of all of the members of the Drainage Work Group. There's more than 20 entities who are represented on the Drainage Work Group, and a few of those members are in the audience today. And again, this work group has been operating as a consensus body for about 3 years, and as Senator Sparks indicated, in 2007, consensus recommendations from the work group were considered and passed by the legislature. And this is in Senate File 364, another iteration of the work of the Drainage Work Group and their consensus recommendations. In Senate File 364, there are four primary areas that the work group is recommending some revisions of Minnesota drainage law. And also, they're also recommending additional funding for drainage records modernization. The first area that the bill addresses within drainage law is Section 103E227, which is the impoundment section of drainage law that is oftentimes used for projects that involve different types of impoundments on drainage systems. It could be for flood control. It could be a wetland restoration type of project. But those types of projects do require the petitioner to seek authority or approval from the drainage authority for that type of a project on a public drainage system. The primary objective of the proposed, the recommended revisions to Section 227 are to clarify, but also to add another function that the section didn't envision when it was first written, and that is rerouting of a drainage system. Sometimes when a wetland restoration, for example, is done on a public drainage system, the elevations are such that a tile, for example, can't be outletted into that wetland restoration and must be rerouted around the restoration in order that the system upstream remains functional. Same thing can happen with an open ditch system too, depending upon the elevations of the system and of the area where the impoundment lies. So that was one of the recommended changes to 103E227, is to enable that type of situation. It also improves, if you will, the ability for a project sponsor, a conservation program, or other entity who wants to partner for a project with the drainage authority. And the revisions that the work group is recommending enable those types of partnerships more easily, more clearly. There's also been a concern that was raised about the maintenance responsibilities for example, a rerouted system. It wasn't perfectly clear in the existing drainage law that if a rerouted system was put in place, that the operation and maintenance for that would be accomplished by the drainage system as if it was, in fact, then the original, if you will, part of that system. So it becomes part of the existing drainage system, and therefore it makes sense for that drainage system to be the maintainer of it. Another section of drainage law that the work group is recommending revisions is 103E805. And that section is about partial abandonment or removal of property from a public drainage system. And the primary objective of the Drainage Work Group recommendations for this section are to clarify. There is no change in the criteria for removal or partial abandonment. But because those two functions were placed together in existing Section 805, it was somewhat unclear as to exactly the procedure that the drainage authority should use for either a removal or a partial abandonment. And therefore, the work group's recommendations will clarify that primarily by separating those two functions. So the work group is recommending a new Section 806 for the partial abandonment function and leaving the removal function in Section 805. Another objective of the drainage work group recommendations that are in this bill are to update certain dollar limits and thresholds within drainage law. You may recall that last year during session there was a recommendation brought forward in a bill to increase the repair fund limit within drainage law. Whenever we took a look at that, it had not been increased since 1980, and therefore there were good reasons to increase that just because of inflation. And while the drainage work group was looking at that issue that was raised last session but not addressed during session, we also took a look at other dollar limits and thresholds to update those. We had assistance from Mr. Knopf to help us look at the history of when those provisions were put in place so that we could consider inflationary increases. And the other thing that we considered was the modifications that were made last session to the Uniform Municipal Contracting Law. The thresholds in that law were raised. They were changed last year. And so we considered those when developing some recommendations for update of those dollar limits and thresholds. And you will see then in the bill that there are a number of different modifications recommended for dollar limits and thresholds in different parts of existing drainage law. One more item that the drainage work group is recommending that's included in this bill is to provide additional state cost share for drainage records modernization. You may recall that during the past biennium, there was funding appropriated to the Board of Water and Soil Resources in the second year of the biennium for drainage records modernization challenge grants. Those were, in fact, given out to 22 drainage authorities this current fiscal year to help cost share the update of drainage records within their jurisdiction. We had a total of 44 applications for a total of $500,000 that was appropriated 2 years ago. And again, we were able to provide funding for 22 of 44 applications. I would also like to point out to you, Mr. Chairman, members, that there is another document in your folder that provides some additional background on the recommendations of the Drainage Work Group. It is titled Drainage Work Group 2008 Consensus Recommendations, dated 1809. And I would just point this out to you that there is some explanation along the right side of this document for each of the changes that the work group is recommending within drainage law. There's also at the back of it some explanation about their recommendation for additional cost share for drainage records modernization. One more piece of information that I think will be of interest to you is that during fiscal year 2008, the legislature had charged the Board of Water and Soil Resources to develop drainage records modernization guidelines. That was also a recommendation of the drainage work group from a few years back. And in fact, we did work with the Minnesota State University Mankato Water Resource Center to develop those guidelines. They are available on the Bowser website. And in fact, in that first handout that I mentioned, there is a link to those guidelines on the Bowser webpage. With that, Mr. Chairman, the only other thing I'd like to mention to you is that you may be aware that within the governor's budget, there isn't the $500,000 for drainage records modernization that is included in this document, and I just want you to know that that's a reality, and I'm speaking on behalf of the drainage workers. So with that, I would entertain questions.
Fair deal.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Keene, if a landowner partially abandons a drainage system and then the farm is sold, is there some way for him to, for the next owner to get back into the system?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, once that partial abandonment occurs, the area where it does occur, and oftentimes that is the very upstream ends of systems, where the drainage authority will grant an abandonment. For example, if a wetland restoration is done and there's some drainage system at or within that restoration area or just upstream on that property owner's land, it may be partially abandoned. And so that is off the books, if you will. It's no longer part of the system. If a landowner wanted to restore drainage within that, they would need to petition then for either a lateral or petition for a new outlet, if you will, of private drainage system, for example.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Keene, how hard is that to do?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, I can't give you statistics on it, but in my understanding, petitions for new drainage are processed by drainage authorities all the time. It's not an unusual situation for there to be a landowner petitioning for an outlet into a public drainage system. Laterals are much less frequent, but certainly I see reports, engineers' reports for those in my role at Bowser as well.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Keene, on the $1 million you want to keep track of drainage records, modernize them, and so forth, is that for both ditches and tile lines?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, yes, it would be for both open ditches and tile that are part of a public system.
Senator Engelbretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Ditch authority has the authority to tax, correct, in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the ditch authority has the authority to assess.
I'm sorry, to assess.
The same.
Yes. Okay, follow-up. Should a state property be part of the ditch? How is the payment there? I mean, is that, you talk about payment in lieu of taxes. Is there an additional tax on that state property? Does the state required to pay X amount of taxes if their land follows alongside of the ditch? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, public land can be assessed as well as private lands. There are situations such as the consolidated conservation lands in northern Minnesota where there are public drainage systems, and the way that the state has paid assessments has been a topic of discussion and different appropriations for that at times. But the bottom line is that yes, state land that is on a public drainage system can be assessed as well as the private lands. And just another piece of information that may be helpful in that regard is that when viewers are appointed, who are the folks who define benefits and damages, they will define benefits for all lands that are served by that system. And it's assessed out or appropriated out, if you will, defined as a percentage so that all of the land adds up to 100%. And every time there's a cost for a particular drainage system, it is assessed according to those percentages. So
everybody pays.
That's right. Everybody pays.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Keene. Just a couple of questions. One, just out of curiosity, on your drainage work group, you list the Minnesota Viewers Association. Can you tell us, or tell me, maybe I'm the only one who doesn't know what that is. Could you explain that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, as I mentioned to Senator Ingebrigtsen, viewers are the defined individuals in drainage law, defined by drainage law, and there is a definition of, you know, what that role is in drainage law to define benefits and damages for public drainage systems. And there has been for a number of years, on the order of decades, a Minnesota Viewers Association who do try to provide training. They provide technology transfer, if you will, so that there is more consistency in how they do business and maintain, if you will, the professionalism of their role.
And Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Keene. Is there a particular qualification to be a viewer? Is there a license? Is there education? Or is it just a kind of a someone is asked to do it or just has acquired some experience looking at ditches? I'm just unfamiliar with that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, there aren't any defined licensures for it. Many of the viewers do have an assessor, not an assessor, I'm trying to think about the right terminology. Doesn't come to me. Someone who is defining value of property and value of effects on property.
Appraiser,
thank you. But within drainage law, there is a definition of who it can be. It needs to be a disinterested citizen of Minnesota. There aren't, though, certification requirements. It is primarily based upon experience and, for example, the Minnesota Viewers Association, who does try to provide education as well.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank Mr. Keene, and part of it's always for me an opportunity to learn something new, and so I've learned today what the Viewers Association and what a viewer is, and I appreciate that. But, Mr. Chairman, just one other comment. It's calling for $1 million, $500,000 appropriation over 2 years. Do we know yet where the money is going to come from or how we're going to deal with the budget and where this would fit into that? I'm a little reluctant to in other committees to agree to do appropriations until we have some feel for how this is going to work.
Senator Hand, if you want my my projection, I don't know if there's any money for anything. But we will see by the time we move along what things will come. I'll ask my financial expert over here to tell me when the money is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, this bill would have to go to finance, and the appropriation would go to Bowser, which is actually in Senator Anderson's budget division. So,
okay. Senator Engelbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more point of clarity. So when you reroute a ditch, there's a good reason for it, obviously. But if that happens to be downstream from me, three-quarters of a mile, say I'm a mile and a half away from that reroute, it's really not benefiting me. Am I still going to be taxed for that rerouting cost?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, first let's talk about a tile, for example, that would be rerouted, because that's probably the more frequent situation, because there isn't enough elevation to difference slope, if you will, in the land surface to outlet that tile into a wetland restoration, for example. And therefore, in order to enable that tile to be fully functional upstream, it needs to reroute around that wetland restoration. And the way that the drainage work group is recommending that the potential for partnerships and funding, it is up to the drainage authority to determine whether or not the drainage system would participate in that or not. It could be, for example, though, that it is to the advantage of the drainage system where, for example, if I had a tile that was quite shallow through a drained wetland basin, and it keeps blowing out because it doesn't have enough cover and there's too much head on it, if you will. So it becomes a maintenance problem for the drainage system. A reroute would actually save the system money in terms of maintenance costs for which reason the drainage authority on behalf of that system may agree to participate in that reroute as a beneficial project for both the wetland restoration and the drainage system. And a similar thing could be true for an open ditch, and less frequent that I think that occurs. But if, in fact, there is issues with that stretch of ditch where this impoundment is occurring, and it would be beneficial to the system to have a new ditch that's constructed differently or in different elevation of land that would be more stable, it may also be something advantageous to both the project and the drainage system.
Just one more follow-up, and then I'll let it go here. So should there be a disagreement amongst the authority and the landowner that the landowner doesn't think that it is quite that much of a benefit to me or to my neighbor, there's a process then, I think, that moves forward and attorneys get involved. A lot of dollars are expended, I understand. I'm speaking like I might have some experience there, and I have. So it just seems like a very cumbersome process. And is that something?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, again, the process for a petition and the hearings that are required under 103E227, it is a due process to ensure that all landowners who would be potentially affected by the project have an opportunity to speak with their drainage authority. It is, in fact, up to the drainage authority in the end on their behalf to make the decision on behalf of the system. And, of course, there are other due process available, even via the courts, mm-hmm. if necessary. As an example of experience in that regard, the Board of Water and Soil Resources does many wetland restoration projects for the Reinvestment Minnesota Reserve Program and the partnerships that we have with federal programs as well. And we do many of these restorations on public drainage systems where we need to petition the drainage authority to do them. Certainly as part of our standard operating procedure, we try to be very careful that we're not worsening conditions for anyone, and that if we believe it is in the interest of both the landowner who we're working with on a conservation program and the drainage system, we will make recommendations to the drainage authority. But again, in the end, it's their call, and that is that authority was kept very clear in the revisions that the work group has recommended.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, I need a motion. Senator Laurie moves that Senate File 364 be recommended to pass, and we have to send it back to Finance. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Senator Laurie, you're up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
How are you doing, Lisa? Okay.
Doing very well. Class 19, pick me up.
Good. Senator Laurie will be working on Senate File 484.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Laurie with Senate File 484. As you say, this is a Department of Ag housekeeping, rather technical bill. It does a few things. Actually, I do have an author's amendment to move. I don't think it was. I went through my packet. I didn't see it. But if that can get passed out, we'll adopt it as soon as everybody has it. I'll describe the bill with it in it. Section 1 modifies and renames the Food Safety Task Force by adding the word defense so that the new name would be Food Safety and Defense Task Force. This clarification really allows the Department of Ag to potentially access federal funds on food safety and defense programs.
Senator
technical.
Laurie?
The second
Senator
section.
Larry, maybe we ought to move your amendment to your bill in order.
I'm coming right up to where that is effective. So I'll move the A1 amendment.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now your bill in order.
All right. That amendment is all in section 2, which I was just going to start on. It expands the organic, the section expands the organic tax force and changes the sunset date. It expands the task force charged so that it, the task force advises the U of M as well as the Commissioner of Ag. It changes organic food to organic products in order not to exclude participation by the rapidly growing organic categories such as organic body care, cosmetics, fiber, and even cocoa bean mulch, I suppose. It adds one at-large seat, providing flexibility and making it possible to include some of these emerging areas. And then the A1 amendment added one organic retailer in addition. Section 3 of the bill is repealers. There are two essentially unnecessary reports that are still required by statute and would be repealed under this. The first is a annual report on aquaculture development. The report is really unnecessary as there's very little aquaculture business in Minnesota. Only one company, Min Aqua in Renville, has succeeded actually in staying in business. We should make specifically clear that the statutes requiring MDA to still promote aquaculture will remain intact. The second, and if we do start making progress on that, it might be appropriate at that time to start looking at a report again, but at this time there really is no activity in this area, and an annual report is really an undue burden. So the second report is an annual report on invasive species. This one is really duplicative and somewhat time-consuming. MDA already issues a larger division report, which includes actually a pretty comprehensive section on invasive species, and so by eliminating the duplication there, the agency can better focus their time. That is the extent of the bill. We've got Quinn Cheney here from the Department of Ag. If anybody has any questions,
please stand
for those now.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a question, I don't know, Senator Lurie or maybe Ms. Cheney, but Section 1 of the bill, does this provision put it into then the veterans bill or take it out of the ag bill by adding the word defense to the?
No, it would be food defense.
Okay, I just want to, and just on a more serious note, could you clarify, you mentioned that this allows some federal funding, but what is that? What does that change to? I'm not sure if
there's some federal programs available for food safety and defense purposes. And they'd be available to states that had food safety and defense activity going on. And when we had one that was just food safety, it didn't necessarily allow us to apply for some of these federal programs. We're not guaranteeing any additional federal money, but there's the ability to apply with this technical change.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question maybe for Quinn. How much money are we talking about that we could possibly leverage from the federal government with this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson, I don't necessarily know that it's a lot of money. I know, for example, that there was some funding from the FDA for some training. That was $5,000 that we might have been able to access. It's not a significant amount. And I certainly don't know if there's any new funding as far as stimulus monies or anything like that that might come forward. But we just wanted to be able to take full advantage. And it was an oversight from the previous year when we created the task force in the first place. It was something we probably should have thought to do and just didn't.
And this and food safety and defense is the federal term of art, really. And so it's just wise for us on the front end to comply with that. As new opportunities arise, we would assume that the feds would continue to use that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lurie, I'm just looking at the part that has to do with the advisory council.
Yes.
I see you changed it from the commissioner appointing the members to the commissioner working in consultation with several other groups here or representatives of those groups. I'm wondering if someone, since they're appointing an organics advisory committee, if somebody from the organics community shouldn't be part of the group that appoint the members? Because right now it just seems to be institutional people.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that was actually a recommendation from the organic task force that we restructure the task force this way. And Tom Peterson, who's the chairman of that task force, is certainly here, and he could comment on that.
Would you like Sure. Mr. Peterson's comments, Tom?
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and Senators, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, but I'm also chair of the Organic Advisory Task Force, and I wasn't sure I understood the question quite right.
Well, thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Chair, Mr. Peterson, I was just wondering, on the people who get together to appoint the Organics Advisory Board, that there seems to be no people from the organics community involved with that. They're just folks from the universities or institutions along with a commissioner. And I wonder if someone from the organic ag community shouldn't be part of the group that appoints the council.
Mr. Chairman and members and on the third page of the bill, then it does say, you know, the commissioner. This is what the task force had talked about. Instead of the commissioner making the recommendations now, we met about a couple months ago with Dean Levine and Dean Durgan from the university and talked about the university had considered starting their own task force. And we told them, you know, we have a task force, and a lot of people from the university are already on the task force. And so everybody put their heads together and say, we could just do this together. And that was the process that we came up with. And we think it's been fairly, you know, pretty fair so far on how the task force has been running for almost, I think, must be almost 15 years, and that it's their open meetings, their process has been very good. I've been on the task force for 6 years. I think 4 years ago the commissioner appointed me chair, and I really appreciated the opportunity, and I think it's been a good process, and I think going forward that the university and the deans and the commissioner will make good choices on that. I appreciate your comment, but that's kind of how we came up with that.
Mr. Coy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Lori, staff tells me that Section 3, the repealer, is an ag finance issue. It's in the governor's budget. And so we will need to remove Section 3 from the bill and send the rest of it on to local, state and local, because it's the task force. So I don't know if you want to move that. Section 3, the repealer, would be laid on the table in here, so it could be considered as part of the ag finance provision or not. But the repealer is an agriculture finance issue and would need to stay in this committee.
I guess I would initially ask maybe for staff or council to explain the fiscal implications a little bit, because it's really two reports that are being...
Senator Lori, Mr. Mueller can...
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, and at least my reading of the repealer, there's some proposals in the governor's budget to eliminate general fund funding for aquaculture and some of the invasive species issues. So I assume that, and it doesn't really seem that those two reporting requirements have anything to do with this task force. So I assume that we should probably keep those repealers in this division depending on what we do with the governor's budget recommendations, because they seem more tied to the funding issues in the governor's proposal. Unless Ms. Cheney has some different idea of that.
Ms. Cheney, you got an answer for that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoia, we would actually like to get rid of this report regardless of what happens to the governor's budget. The governor's budget proposed to eliminate one staff person in the marketing division, which a person who handles aquaculture and other issues. We believe that we would like to pursue the elimination of the report regardless of what happens with that particular...
Well, and Mr. Chair and Ms. Cheney, I'm not saying that it isn't going to happen, but that action is going to be taken in the Ag Finance Committee, and we can send the task force on to state and local, but that would be an Ag Finance decision. So I will move, we remove Section 3 from Senate File 484 and lay it on the table.
Everybody understand the motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now, Senator Lurie, what else is in your bill?
Nothing. I move Senate File 484, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the state and local government.
Okay. Understand the motion? Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. One final bill, members, and Senator Dill.
Bill
133.
Bill.
Resolution.
There is this more about horses and stock?
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 133 is a resolution that was prepared and approved by the National Council of State Legislatures, and there's a number of states that are considering this resolution this legislative session. I picked it up and put it in, and Mr. Knopf put it into our system here and drafted the bill, and I think the language is pretty much identical to what the National Council of State Legislatures had put forward. And just so everybody gets a drift of this, I'm going to just read the text of this legislation, this resolution, so you can hear what the different points are. We're memorializing Congress to oppose federal legislation that interferes with a state's ability to direct the transport or processing of horses. Whereas the processing of horses has become a controversial and emotional issue and has resulted in the closing of all horse processing facilities throughout the United States, and whereas federal legislation was introduced to amend the 1970 Horse Protection Act to prohibit the shipping, transporting, moving, delivering, receiving, processing, purchasing, selling, or donation of horses and other equines for processing and other purposes, and whereas the loss of secondary markets has severely affected the livestock industry by eliminating the salvage value of horses and has significantly reduced the market value of all horses, and whereas prohibition on the processing of horses has resulted in a significant increase in abandoned and starving animals and have had significant economic impact on the entire equine industry, and whereas the increase in unwanted and unusable horses has overwhelmed private animal welfare agencies and the public's ability to care for surplus domestic horses, and whereas the annual number of unwanted or unusable surplus domestic horses is estimated to be 100,000, and whereas issues related to the humane handling and slaughter of surplus domestic horses are best addressed by proper regulations and inspection and not by banning or exporting, whereas state agricultural and rural leaders recognize the necessity and benefit of the state's ability to direct the transport and processing of horses, now therefore be it resolved by the legislature of the state of Minnesota that it urges that the Congress of the United States to oppose federal legislation that interferes with the state's ability to direct the transport and processing of horses. Now I'd like to direct you to a handout that I've got, which I'll go through. It's identified, has that been passed out yet?
Yes.
Okay, it's identified as Senate File 133 supporters. Supporters of the resolution urging Congress to oppose federal legislation interfering with the state to direct the transport or processing of horses includes the American Association of Equine Practitioners, this is an association of veterinarians, the American Quarter Horse Association, the American Veterinary Medical Association, the Midwest Council of State Governments, the Minnesota Association of Equine Practitioners, the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association, the Minnesota Horse Council, the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, the National Council of State Legislatures,
And then Farm Bureau gave me a letter of support here at the beginning of this meeting, and I think that's been passed out as well. Is that correct? So that makes 10 organizations supporting this resolution. Now, if you go to the second page of the resolution, there's just a few things that I'm identifying here, which kind of gives us a little more information on this. In 2005, the U.S. horse population was just about at 10 million horses. That's what it was estimated. It's probably just a little less than that. In 2006, 140,000 unwanted, unusable horses are sold to processing plants. In May of 2007, the two Texas horse processing plants closed due to legislation and court rulings. And in September of 2007, the last horse processing plant in the U.S. closes due to legislation and court rulings, which was located in DeKalb, Illinois. In 2007, the price of horses dropped from 40 to 50 cents a pound to probably 20 cents a pound. Tom Peterson of Farmers Union tells me at these horse auction sales, there's horses selling for 10 bucks a head. So it's probably dropped even more than that. In 2007, 78,000 horses are exported to Mexico and Canada for processing. 2008, a bill is introduced into the U.S. House of Representatives to ban the transport of horses out of the U.S. for processing. September of 2008, the bill passes out of the U.S. Judiciary Committee and is referred to the Agricultural Committee. No further action is taken. 2008, unwanted horses are being turned loose on federal, state, and private land. Horse sanctuaries are filling up with unwanted horses. Disposal costs are rising. Instead of selling an unwanted horse for $500, horse owners are facing a $100 to $250 fee for euthanasia and disposal. Now, this meat, horse meat, has been exported to Japan, Canada, and Europe, primarily France and Belgium. And when we got 1 billion people around the world suffering from malnutrition, starvation, and so forth, it seems like a waste of protein to me to be putting these horses in the ground and not further utilizing them. Now, if you go to the third page, there's just a few little short excerpts here on 2009 legislative action in Montana and North Dakota. In the states that are considering a resolution like you've got before you, that some of them have passed the resolution, include Arizona, Kansas, Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Utah, and Wyoming. And there's further action to open up horse processing in Arkansas, Illinois, Missouri, and Montana. And that middle article there, no job, no home, no horse, that's the problem. We're in a recession. People are short of money. They can't afford to feed their horses anymore. And that at the bottom is a little short article about some stuff going on in the Minnesota House. If you turn to the back page, you'll see two articles, one about Montana passing legislation or considering legislation to start a horse slaughterhouse. In North Dakota, at the bottom or the middle of the page, you're considering similar legislation. Now, I've got a few more comments that I can make, but as I understand it, there's some people that would like to testify on this bill, and I think I'll wait, Mr. Chairman, for the testimony, and then I'll have a few more comments. Now, if there's anybody in the audience that wants a copy of this handout that I just read, I'll stick it right here.
Any questions of Senator Dill? Not Senator Dill, we've got some people that want to testify against your bill. We'll hear from them, that'll open it up to the floor if we have somebody else. First one would be Howard Goldman, Humane Society of the U.S. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Howard Goldman, and I'm the Minnesota State Director for the Humane Society of the United States. We have 180,000 members and supporters in Minnesota, and I'm here to oppose the bill. Let me say at the outset, Senator Dill referenced legislation in Congress which would prohibit the transport processing of horses in the United States or to Mexico or Canada, which is currently where all the horse slaughter plants are. Horse slaughter is not banned in the United States at this point. The recent closures occurred in Texas and in Illinois because the state legislatures there took that action. So it's not banned nationwide. Moreover, the bill that Senator Dill references, the Burton-Conyers bill, has been introduced into the House. There is no Senate companion to the bill. No hearings have been scheduled. So at this point in time, the likelihood of passage is anyone's guess, frankly, and I suppose it's fairly remote. So the basis for this proposal, really, in my judgment, is in question because there is no federal bill at this point in time. I should also mention that I'm a horse owner. I've been a horse owner for 17 years. The horse is a beloved icon in America. It's much like the bald eagle, symbol of our freedom, our independence, and our heritage. As a nation, our country was built on the backs of horses. Never have they been part of our diet. We raise horses for work, for sport, for pleasure, not for dinner. Americans don't want their horses eaten any more than they want dogs or cats or other companion animals to be eaten. In the past several years, as the senator stated, all the horse slaughter plants in the U.S. have been closed. Now horses slaughtered for food in Mexico, where they can be shipped from Minnesota or any other state for slaughter, are being sent to Belgium and France, Germany and Japan. Simply put, foreign-owned companies are slaughtering our horses. They were never bred or raised for food in this country. The lack of horse slaughter facilities in this country has not led to more horses being abandoned or neglected. When California banned horse slaughter in 1998, it saw no rise in horse cruelty or neglect. When Illinois shut down its plants in 2002 for 2 years, the Department of Agriculture documented a drop, a slight decrease in horse cruelty. Despite claims that horses slaughtered are old, sick, or lame, this is not the case. Many horses were unknowingly sold to slaughter, while some are stolen and sold for a profit. Killer buyers and slaughterhouse operators would like you to believe that they're performing a service to these horses by slaughtering them. In truth, a very small number may be sick or injured because of neglect, but the vast majority are sound and in good health. The USDA statistics show that 92% of all horses slaughtered were in good condition, meaning that those horses would have gone to new owners where they could have led productive lives. These animals were purchased by opportunistic buyers who, in many cases, outbid families and horse brokers for good, sound horses that could have served as companion animals. Instead of finding homes, these horses wound up at slaughter plants destined for restaurants overseas. Now, as the senator mentioned, there are some families, of course, that can no longer afford to maintain their horses, but there are options short of slaughter. They can be sold to new owners, placed at equine rescues or sanctuaries, or even with 4-H groups, or euthanized humanely, which is what we had to do several years ago with our own horse. Horses, by their very nature, respond to hostile and frightening environments by trying to flee. For this reason, they cannot reliably be slaughtered in a humane fashion. While federal law is supposed to require that horses are rendered unconscious prior to slaughter, usually with a captive bolt pistol, which shoots a metal rod into the horse's brain, undercover footage has shown that horses were not stunned and are kicking unconscious when they were shackled and hoisted by a rear leg to have their throats cut. Horse slaughter cannot be made humane due to the very nature of horses. In addition, conditions in the slaughterhouses are very stressful and frightening. A set of documents that the Humane Society of the United States obtained through the Freedom of Information Act clearly demonstrates that U.S. horses slaughtered, that is to say that U.S. horse slaughterhouses had problems with employees whipping horses across the face with fiberglass rods, horses flipping over backwards, and the use of long bull whips in the holding pen. The cruelty of horse slaughter is not limited to the slaughter process itself. Horses are shipped frequently under very inhumane conditions, over long distance, very overcrowded, with little food or water. In 2006, a national survey was conducted by Public Opinion Strategies. and it showed that nearly 70% of Americans are strongly against the slaughter of American horses for human consumption overseas. Minnesota ranks in the top 10 for horse ownership. There's more than 180,000 horses in the state, but the vast majority are used for enjoyment and for showing recreation. These people, and I count myself amongst them, would be very unhappy to learn that our horses had ended up in a slaughterhouse. For all of these reasons, we urge the committee to oppose this resolution. I might say that the Animal Humane Society, the largest shelter in the state, and also the Minnesota Humane Society, also oppose this legislation. Thank you.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm sorry I did not get your name.
Howard Goldman.
Mr. Goldman, thank you. Mr. Goldman, is the Humane Society opposed to the slaughter of pigs, cattle, poultry, other animals, or is it just horses that they're opposed to?
The Humane Society of the United States is very concerned about the confinement systems used to raise pigs, cattle, and so on, but we are not opposed to the slaughter of pigs and cattle and so on.
And Mr. Goldman, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Goldman, I appreciate, I think you're right. I don't think people in this country typically are consumers of horse meat, at least not knowingly. I guess what I'm unclear about is why, if there was a business that was catering to a market that where that was desirable, why that should be opposed any more than we should oppose the slaughter of chickens, turkeys, pigs. There are many people who don't like those foods either, but we don't take the position that we shouldn't permit a business who wants to do that. I guess I'm failing to see what the distinction is between how the Humane Society would view a horse versus other animals. If you're saying that you're against all slaughter of all animals for productive purposes, I could understand that. But why just the one? I'm not sure if I understand that.
Mr. Goldman, you have an answer to that? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the Humane Society of the United States considers horses, and particularly the way they've been slaughtered, to be especially cruel. And I believe that's the reason that the organization is focused on horses. We're very concerned about confinement and cruelty that goes on in factory farms. But the conditions at the horse slaughterhouses are particularly egregious, and that's why we focused on horses.
Any other questions? No, thank you. The next person up is Eleanor Pershing, I believe it is.
Eleanor, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Eleanor here. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Eleanor Pershing, and I am a horse owner and have been riding and working with horses for over the past 25 years. Although I do not represent any formal group, I am certain that my viewpoint is shared among my fellow horse owners, which in Minnesota are great in number, having the second highest per capita horse population in the nation. I'm here today to voice my support against reinstating horse slaughter in the United States and that we should further prohibit the export of horses to Canada and Mexico for slaughter. In America, horses are used for sport, recreation, and pleasure. They are not bred and raised for human consumption, and I believe that the state should have an obligation to create policies which reflect this to be the case. Had the slaughterhouses not been closed in the United States, my horse, a thoroughbred from off the track, and thousands of others just like him, would have been sent immediately to an auction after he stopped winning his races and most likely would have been inhumanely slaughtered by a captive bolt. Had he been close to the border of Mexico, he would have endured an even more tragic and gruesome death by knife. Since there was no quick and easy means for his disposal, he instead came to a farm and was offered for sale. He is now enjoying a second career as a pleasure horse and hopeful jumper who will live out his natural life in a caring home. Without utilizing a formal program, we, a group of horse owners, collectively at our farm have placed over a dozen of horses in new homes over the past year. We do this voluntarily on our own time and make no profit from our endeavors. This past Saturday, a former racehorse was placed with an equestrian school in Wisconsin where he will have to endure the kind attention of 18-year-old girls for the duration of his life. Even in this economic environment, there are homes to be had by our horses. Our small efforts pale in comparison to the work of the more than 400 equine adoption and rescue organizations across the country that place these horses on a daily basis. According to the USDA, more than 92% of the horses slaughtered were in good condition. They could have, if given a chance, also found caring new homes. In California, the NorCal Equine Rescue has recently started a low-cost euthanasia program for owners who can no longer care for their animals that are not suitable for adoption. Among the animals euthanized were a 20-year-old mare with Cushing's disease, a geriatric horse owned by a senior citizen on a fixed income, and others brought to a clinic by another rescue financially unable to bear the cost of euthanizing physically disabled horses. NorCal's program was recently featured on NPR on March 6th and is currently being replicated by other rescue organizations. It is sad to think that this type of program is even necessary, but this option should spare a good number of horses the trauma of going to an auction and a long truck ride to a tragic death. The economic crisis has put a strain on all of us, horses and humans alike, and it calls for a long-range planning that is reflective of our concerns, conscience, and compassion. It is clear that there are indeed options for horses that are both productive and humane, and slaughter should not be considered as an alternative. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? No, we have Drew Fitzpatrick, I think I've said it right. Come on up. He's a state humane agent for Minnesota Hooved Animal Rescue Foundation, is that right? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Drew Fitzpatrick. I am the director of the Minnesota Hooved Animal Rescue Foundation. We are an equine organization that has existed for more than 20 years, but we have been active in publishing a educational newsletter and 501c3 status, et cetera, for greater than 15 years now. I'm also a Minnesota State Humane Agent. I've been a Minnesota State Humane Agent for greater than 10 years, and I've specialized in equines. I've taught other humane agents how to deal with equine humane issues, et cetera, et cetera. The organization that I founded and still direct has been very busy lately. It started in about 2007. We had a hay drought in this area. There was a bad drought, and hay prices skyrocketed. I paid the winter of 2007-08, I paid $6 to $7 a bale for the hay that I buy. Usually it's about $2 a bale, maybe $2.50. This caused a lot of people to abandon their ideas of owning horses. They did not necessarily abandon their horses. We saw no more horses skipping down the road than we usually do. There's usually those horses that will push down a fence, or the kid leaves a gate open or something, and they go loose. And the sheriff's departments know who to call. They call us. We remove the road hazard, which is usually a live horse because we do it quickly. And the people have the opportunity to fix their fences or whatever and get their animal back. And this is what happens all the time. I think that there's an awful lot of myth going on with animals being abandoned in droves at state lands and so forth. As a state humane agent, knowing all the other state humane agents in the state, I've only known of four horses that you could honestly say were probably abandoned in the state of Minnesota. Otherwise, it seems to be a lot of myth and a lot of talk. The organization that I run averages the animals in the program average between 60 to 100 head. And those are the ones that are in the program, not that have been adopted out, not that are pending in humane cases or something like that. There's about 60 to 100 head floating around getting their veterinary work done, being looked at by prospective adopters, et cetera, et cetera. And the adoptions have been holding steady. There was a little drop when the hay went skyrocketing in adoptions. But now it seems that intake and adoptions are pretty well equal. Humane cases are also holding steady. Most recent cases have been those of long-standing that the economy and our persistence in investigation have recently resolved. Calls into investigations may be up due to animal planning. Isn't that great? People are learning what constitutes humane abuse or humane neglect, et cetera, et cetera. They see it on Animal Planet. They know who to call now. That's why I think calls may be up a little bit. But mostly what we're seeing is that these calls are resolved with education very easily. We are not seizing these animals. Humane calls may be up, but we're not seizing animals like we have been in the past. Just did two humane cases in February. Nine horses were surrendered under duress. They needed to leave this property, and the people did surrender them because they realized that they could not deal with the problem. It was an economic problem. The other one was horses that had gotten loose. One got hit by a truck. The other two were picked up and taken to our shelter, and they had been released by the owners. The horse industry. I've been involved in the horse industry in many facets for all my life. Since I was a little kid, I've seen humane cases when I was a young person. It's what got me into the business that I'm in now. I do have a regular job. I don't draw a salary from the shelter. That's just, it's kind of a weird hobby. But I've seen the market ebb and flow over years. And if you talk to someone who's been in the horse industry for years and years, they will tell you also that of the Shetland pony boom and bust, the Arabian horse boom and bust, things happen within the horse industry that are always creating a surplus of animals and then a problem. The economy 10 years ago was pretty poor, and if you're looking at horse meat prices going from 40 cents a pound down to 20 cents a pound, it's not unusual. 10 years ago, you could also get a horse at an auction for $8, $5, and many of the similar things were happening. I don't believe that all this is because of the cessation of slaughter. It's just, it happened at the same time that we had droughts all over the United States, the economic problems, et cetera, et cetera. As an operator of an equine rescue, I wanted to be here today. I thought it was very important to let you know that we believe that the slaughter of horses is wrong, that the meat that is produced by the slaughter of horses is tainted. There is no slaughter withdrawal date on many of the drugs that are given to horses. Many of the drugs that I use in the horses in the shelter, you cannot give those drugs ever to an animal that is intended for food purposes. On cattle, sheep, swine, everything, there is a slaughter withdrawal date. That is not so in equine medicine. They just oftentimes will say not to be used in horses intended for food purposes. On our dewormers, I use dewormers several times the first month the horse comes into me. I'm just very surprised that we haven't had more problems with people overseas getting really, really sick. I've heard that there have been problems with birth defects and spontaneous abortion in pregnant women in Europe because of horse meat consumption. I don't know if that's true. I've just heard that. I could assume that it probably would happen after looking at some of the drugs and et cetera, et cetera. I've run this organization for 15 years. I'm not overwhelmed. I'm really busy, but I'm not overwhelmed. And I don't want to see slaughter brought back. We're running programs. We're starting new things. The euthanasia clinics, assisting people. The horse community has stood up and is helping us tremendously. Fort Dodge and has donated vaccine. The veterinarians, what is the name of that organization? There's an organization of veterinarians, and all veterinarians support slaughter. But there is one organization within the veterinary community that has decided to do something, even though they still probably support slaughter. They've decided to help the shelters, and they are donating vaccine to reputable 501c3 shelters to help us with costs and et cetera, et cetera. I helped get that program in place, and it's just going to start. The vaccine should be delivered to those reputable rescues on the 1st. So we're getting things together. I guess if you gave me an airplane tomorrow, I've always wanted one, but if you gave me one tomorrow, I wouldn't know what to do with it. This is kind of what's happened. Horses aren't being slaughtered. Give us a little more time before you reinstitute slaughtering of horses. I think we've got a handle on it. I've talked to other directors of other shelters, and I would really like the opportunity to continue to do this work that we're doing with the companion animals, the horses in Minnesota. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dill, under your resolution, I'm just looking through here and encircling some of the descriptors of these horses. It's talking about horses of salvage value, starving animals, abandoned animals, unusable horses. And that makes me wonder about what that says about the quality control measures of the horse meat industry. If, I mean, when I go buy my pork chops and pot roast, you know, I'm hoping it's not going to come from a pig that was of salvage value, injured, starving, or unusable. So if this bill is to be creating an outlet where we can dispose of starving, unusable animals, that's one thing. But if the bill is to provide an opportunity for horses to be processed for meat, then I guess I would have a question about regulation and quality control and all of that sort of thing.
Mr. Fitzpatrick, if we're done, I think the questions are going towards Senator Dill.
Senator
so
Dill.
You can thank you for your testimony now. Senator Dill, who is that question to Senator Dill? Do you have Senator Robes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Directly to Senator Dill, well, then do that.
Senator Dill, the question's to you. Thank you, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson-Robes, when we had three processing plants left in America, they were government-inspected plants. And so I'm sure that these sick, starving, inappropriate horses were probably screened out at the time they entered the processing plant, because they're with the pork and cattle industry, sheep industry, goat industry, these are, when you have a meat processing plant, they're either state or USDA inspected plants. And they're inspected twice. They're inspected before they're slaughtered, and they're inspected again after they're slaughtered to make sure they don't have any internal pathology and so forth. Now that they're going to Mexico, we know they don't have the standards we do. Those going to Canada, I presume, are probably up to our standards. But I think the best solution is to reestablish processing plants within the country. It's economic activity. It's jobs. There's a market for it. And a place out west of us here, South Dakota, North Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, some of those states would be, I think, an ideal location for it, and those states are interested in it. But, Mr. Chairman, if I could make just a few comments here, I'd like to recognize and thank those that do run equine rescue organizations, because they are providing a useful service, and I thank them for that. Drew Fitzpatrick is one of them. So I'd like to recognize that, and I'd also like to recognize the fact that many of us keep horses as pets, and they are not intended for shoe leather and horse meat and so forth. And of course, in my case, I buried one of my best horses under the apple tree after it died at age 30. And I had another draft horse that died out in the field while it was cultivating soybeans, and I buried it right where it fell. It took quite a hole and a lot of shovel work, but we got the job done. And my best roping horse and steer wrestling horse, they both passed away at age 30 or 31, and we buried them on the farm in a respectful manner. But this idea of processing horses for slaughter is just one option that we should make available to our horse industry, because we're losing value because they don't have that facility available. And I think we need to also respect cultural differences. Some people in our society don't like to eat pigs. And it would be very inappropriate for somebody to come in and try to make a law against processing or transporting pigs just because they don't think that's a good idea. And there's others that don't like the idea of eating beef. And it would be inappropriate for them to come in and try to pass laws to prevent that. Now, I know eating horses is not culturally acceptable in this country, generally speaking. But I think we need to accept diversity and accept cultural differences and be flexible in our beliefs. If somebody wants to treat a horse as a pet and bury him under the apple tree, that's fine. If they want to process them for meat and get a little extra money out of them, I think that's appropriate too. The other thought I've had is that we do live in a hungry world, And for some people to think they should take this unusable horse, unwanted horse, and kill it, euthanize it, and bury it and let the worms eat it, rather than let some hungry person eat it, it's a waste of good animal protein. I think that's, you know, there's an ethical question there. Why not allow for some recycling? Now, I just checked my driver's license while I was sitting there next to Senator Scully, just to double check to make sure I was an organ donor. And I am an organ donor. So I've made the decision to let my body continue on after my death in some useful way. Let my organs be recycled as they can be recycled. And if I choose to recycle my horse, that should be my decision, and not it shouldn't be outlawed by government. Recycling is good. There's nothing wrong with that. So, and the other thing I was going to mention, which is kind of off the subject in a way, but I have gotten a couple of emails that have quoted the Bible, telling me that I shouldn't eat horse because it's against the Bible. I was going to check with Senator Coogley on this one, but but anyway, they've identified Leviticus chapter 11, verse 3. You may not eat any animal that has a split hoof, completely divided, and that chews the cud. Well, I took and studied this chapter very carefully, Senator Coogley, and I can understand a lot of it. It says you shouldn't eat pigs, and again, we know that, and you're not supposed to eat camels and rabbits, and I guess you're not supposed to eat catfish either, because they don't have fins and scales. But I can't see anything in here that says I can't eat an animal with a full hoof that doesn't chew its cud. So I don't think there's anything in here that says I can't eat a horse. But it does say that I can't eat grasshoppers.
Stuff on the pillow.
I don't have any more opponents on this list, but I do have some that are against your bill. And if you would step aside, I'm going to ask Mr. Peterson to come up, Farmers Union, and Stacy Boland from the Farm Bureau. If they would come up. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Peterson with the Farmers Union, and I wasn't going to, you know, I never know on resolutions, you know, what you're going to do, but this is a really important issue to our members. A couple years ago when we banned the horse slaughter, this was one of our biggest resolutions that our members really wanted this as an option. You know, most of you probably know I've been in the horse business my whole life. When I was old enough to drive our trailer, my mom had me, you know, I hauled horses right down here to South St. Paul to the packing company, and for a lot of families, that was an option. I think of a daughter who was a family that was in 4-H. Their option was to bury the animal and pay $75 to have it euthanized, or we could get them $500, and she could continue showing. And for that family, that was a switch of $800. That was a big deal, and it simply provides an option. This resolution, this is something that we feel Congress is talking about. This is a big issue out in the countryside. The horse owners I talk to, I show horses. I go to the horse auction that's a mile from my house every month. I go to other horse auctions and see the value drop. I've seen the values drop, as the previous testifier said, over the years. We've seen weanling horses for $5. It costs $10 to consign them. So you're basically losing $5 on the horse. And I think that the market has adjusted to that, and I think it'll further adjust down. And so simply saying that right now we have the option to ship them to Canada, to Mexico, that we want to be able to keep that option and have the legislature endorse that as an option. I think it's a big issue. I encourage you to talk to horse owners and see what they think, because I think the majority of them do. You know, as Senator Dill's a horse owner, I'm a horse owner, that this is a viable option. So thank you.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Stacy Boland with Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation, and I'm not going to expound too much more on what was in the letter before you from our president, Kevin Papp, but just wanted to, you should note, too, that Farmers Union and Farm Bureau are up here together. I know some people have that impression that we don't agree on things, but that's not true. We agree on a lot more than people realize. But this, too, for our members, is a huge issue. In fact, we had a group of young farmers in Washington, D.C. last week on the Hill, and this was one of the main issues that they wanted to talk about. not only because they care about horses and having the options for humane and federally regulated options for disposal if you can no longer keep your horse, but they also are concerned about the precedent that this is setting on a federal level. And just to give you a little background on the bill that's introduced right now in Congress, basically what the bill says is that it would be a federal criminal offense to knowingly move, sell, purchase, or transport a horse for human consumption, which would mean if a person was transporting a horse to Canada or Mexico, which are the two options right now, for human consumption, they would be facing a federal criminal penalty if this passes. And so now we're closing down our borders essentially on this option and saying that there's no other options for the 60,000 to 80,000 unwanted horses that were slaughtered previous to this in the United States. And so that's a big concern for us. But also it's a concern of the precedent it's setting that there's criminal prosecution for livestock processing. And I think that question came up earlier about, you know, asking, do we not want hogs to be processed? Do we not want other livestock to be processed? And that's a real concern of ours. If this legislation were to pass, what type of precedent is it setting for livestock slaughter beyond horses? And I want to echo Senator Dill's appreciation for the rescue facilities that are out there because they are an important component. However, there's not enough of them, we're finding. And the American Farm Bureau Federation is currently working with the United States Department of Agriculture on a study to find out, actually assess what's going on with the unwanted horses, how many of them are out there, where they're at, and what can be done about that. And that's a year-long study that's going to culminate with a peer review, and I'm not sure on the timeline on that. But that's something we're talking to Congress about, too. Let's hold off on any legislation until we see any further legislation, until we see what the true numbers are out there and figure out what we can do, because we need an option to dispose of those horses in a humane manner that are unwanted or abandoned.
Any questions from the committee? If not, Senator Dill, your bill is a resolution to Congress. It might sit there till both of us are ready to dig the pasture up. You never know how fast they're going to move. My concern is, I know it's cruel. Some people think it's cruel to put a horse down and maybe sell it. But it's a lot crueler to let that horse wander. And I know a place close to where I am, there was four of them. She woke up in the morning, there was four horses there. But she took and doctored them, got them back to health again. But if you don't have any money, and they're not your horse, just try buying hay once, and you'll see how high-priced it is. There's another thing, Anderson. If you ever hit a horse with your car, it's just like driving into a brick wall. I mean, there's no moving. You can't move a big horse. They just don't. So whatever you do, be careful. If it run around in horses, it wouldn't be liable. But I don't like this either, but we got to do something. We can't just turn them loose. Senator Dill, I remember you saying, well, they're tying them to the streets. I don't think they're doing that yet, but street light posts, but they could be getting close to it. So I think this is a start, and that's why I offered to be on the bill. I want to do something. We can't just let horses be. That's cruel. That's more cruel than putting them to sleep. And I was over to France, and I was tested myself. I said, yeah, Wave, I'll go down. I'll get some horse meat. We'll just try it. I went down there four times, and the more I leaned over to pick this package up, I said, no, I can't do it. And I never did eat it, so I have no idea what a horse meat tastes like. Well, it's wrapped just like you'd buy any
chicken.
I just couldn't do it. Someday I'll go back and try it, just see if it's any good. With that, any other discussion? Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. At Gold? For any of you who are familiar with horse processing, do the processing plants necessarily make meat out of the horses? Is that a foregone thing? What are the does a one processing plant use some of the horses for meat, some for something else? I don't know. What happens at these facilities?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, have not visited a horse processing plant, but I've visited many other processing plants, and practically nothing, or you might say nothing, gets wasted. The meat is probably all harvested and sold as meat, but then you've got bones that are ground up for bone meal and other body parts that might go into dog food or other sausages or some other processed product. And certainly the hide is saved because that's valuable. The one thing that I know, it's when you listen to the Humane Society talk about how they have trouble stunning a horse, and maybe an untrained person would have trouble stunning a horse, but if it's done properly, they can be stunned like any other animal with a bolt or a bullet that enters their brain and renders them unconscious. But the heart does continue to beat after the animal is unconscious, and the animal is hoisted up, and he's unconscious because of he's been stunned, and the throat is cut so that the blood will leave the carcass. And that's just standard operating procedure. And these poultry processing plants are usually disabled with electricity, and they go through this line, and then their throat is cut, and the blood is drained out, and the blood is saved, of course, because it's valuable as a protein product, a blood meal product. So that kind of, and the other thing about this trucking, when you think about the 100 million hogs we've got that are slaughtered every year in this country, and 40 million or so head of cattle, the truckers know how to truck animals. These people are professional at moving animals from the farm to market, or from farm to farm, or from ranch to farm, and so on. There's a tremendous amount of trucking going on. And to talk about how these animals are not being treated humanely in the truck is a little hard for me to believe. It may be an isolated problem here and there, and maybe there's a need for some regulation, but these people are trucking animals as a profession, and they've got to get them safely from point A to point B, and they know how to do it. So I think that they can certainly find examples of inappropriate behavior here and there, but for the most part, the trucking industry knows how to truck livestock, and the meat processing industry knows how to process animals in a relatively humane way.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm having trouble making the connection of why we would make meat out of sick animals or frail animals. And maybe I'm just not understanding the process.
Well,
is there a sorting that goes on? Some are made for meat, some are not. Do either of the other witnesses know how it works?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could answer that question to start with, and maybe there's another answer here, but in our processing of livestock, there's two inspection points. One is ante-mortem, where the veterinarian inspects the animal to make sure it's healthy, and animals that are not healthy are diverted away from the processing for human consumption. And then after the animal is processed, the animal is inspected again to make sure there's no pathology in the animal, and the animal is healthy inside and out.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, is that what happens with horses? With the same process?
Well, I don't know what happens in Mexico, but I'm sure that's what happens in this country, and I presume that's the way it's handled in Canada.
Mr. Chairman, I would just weigh in to say that, you know, I can't speak for horses, but I can speak for cattle. When I was dairy farming, when I'd have a cull cow, I would take her down to Long Prairie. There was a couple of occasions, actually. One occasion I brought the cow down. She was actually standing when I left the farm. When I got down there, she was down and she couldn't get back up. And they wouldn't take her. I actually had to go down to the rendering plant, and I didn't get anything. I actually had to pay to get rid of her, because they actually wouldn't. They don't take down cows. They don't drag them out of there and slaughter. So Senator Chaudhry, there is a culling process where, you know, I think sick ones or down ones or something. And I would assume that horses are the same, is my notion. So.
Any other discussion? Anybody from the audience want to comment? Not Senator Dill. Oh, wait a minute. Did you want to say something more? Come on up.
I would like to. The way that horses are slaughtered, you've raised some very good points about how they're slaughtered and what happens to the cull horses. They kill the good ones. They really like foals. They like ponies. They like the young horses.
Those are the ones that are being shipped for the school lunch programs, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all viable animals that could be doing something else. They may need training, something like this. The animals that are sick, week old,
sign a bill for me.
They need to be euthanized by their owners. They should not enter any kind of a food chain. Nobody in the dog food business is using horses. Nobody. Because people won't buy dog food. Alpo had to change its label, change its blend, because people quit buying Alpo because it said horse meat. We are becoming a society that puts the horse on a different value. There are no real plow horses that have to plow the fields anymore. There's draft horses, sure. They're doing exhibitions and so forth like that. But it's changed. When you kill a horse with a stun gun, and I've seen it, the horse has a long, flexible neck. The stocks are not set up for the horses. The horse sees something coming at it, and because it's a prey animal, it wants to protect its eyes. Its eyes are pretty much fairly close together. I mean, there's like this much room on a regular-sized horse between each eye. And this fellow with this captive bolt gun, which is big, and a bolt comes out of it at the end, and it's on a big stick, he's got to bip that horse right in the center of the head to hit a brain that's the size of a walnut. And they miss. They miss a lot. And I've seen instances where they try and get the horse to come back around, to bring its head back around. There's no containment on its head. Its head is just moving on the end of a long neck. And you know how big a horse is and how long its neck can be. They can move that head all over the place. They start hitting them on the neck to get them to turn their head back into the stun gun. It's just not humane. I'm not advocating that we don't kill horses. I probably put down 25, maybe 30 horses a year because they're sick. They've got cancer. I just donated 2 to the University of Minnesota. Those horses went to the University of Minnesota. One had cancer. One was very old, and he was having arthritic problems. His quality of life wasn't good. I donated those horses. They were euthanized. The students learned from them. I'm happy with that. I'm not advocating not killing them. It's just the manner of their death. And hauling a crippled horse, a horse with a broken leg, a horse that's blind, how do you get X amount of stallions in one trailer to not rip each other apart? It makes it very difficult. And hauling horses is very, very different than cattle and pigs and everything else. They have a long, tall neck. It stands up on the end of their back. And you can't put them in a double-decker truck. It's different. The horse slaughter industry is very different than other industries. I eat meat, you know. I do. I've slaughtered my own hogs on the farm. We even slaughtered a cow. But we were very, very thoughtful about how we did it, and the animal wasn't frightened. I'm not saying that we shouldn't kill horses, but the slaughter industry is not such a good thing. I would much rather see people be educated and have alternatives for euthanasia programs, something, anything, because right now if we start opening up horse slaughter again, the economic problem is going to be so great. People are going to be stealing horses out of the backyards and shipping them again. That was a problem before. A lot of people lost horses when the economy went down and horse meat was relatively stable. A lot of horses were stolen and shipped. It's very, very difficult to track them.
Senator Ingberson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we had testimony. Maybe she would be kind enough to stay there for a question. We had testimony last week, maybe a horse livestock bill, something to the effect that, and maybe you can dispute this or not, but of the total amount of horses in the state of Minnesota, less than 10% of them are actually pets. Is that anywhere close to true?
No. No.
What would be your guess?
Oh, it'd just be a guess. But I would say a great deal. If you look at the economy of the people and the industry of the people that adopt from us, that sponsor programs and so forth, they love horses. They put money into the program. They adopt at quite reasonable fees. Boy, you know, the The University of Minnesota is working real hard. They're fixing problems. People are having surgery done on their horses that are costing thousands of dollars to keep that horse alive, keep it going, instead of selling it for $500. I'd say 75-80%.
Just to follow up on that, now a pet breed would be defined as something that is actually, you know, a pet that is not necessarily used, ridden, you know, used for riding, things like that. One could say those are, you know, the owner's pet, I suppose, but they're more used for income, things like that. I suppose there's a real, the definition of pet probably is pretty broad, I guess.
No, because I don't know. Horses are just really cool big pets that you could ride, you know. They are. And a lot of people really enjoy their horses, and it's more of a member of their family. If you consider the animal to be a member of the family, then I would say that it's certainly higher than 10%.
Thanks.
Certainly.
Mr. Goldman, you get the last word.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senator, the Minnesota Board of Animal Health states the following regarding horses in Minnesota and horses nationally. There's over 9 million horses in the United States today. Most of these horses are kept for recreational purposes. Although 800,000 are involved in the racing industry and others are involved in agriculture. Minnesota is the ninth largest horse population in the nation with over 150,000 horses. So their conclusion is the vast majority are used for recreation.
Mr. Chairman. No.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I support the use of horses for pets, but I also support alternatives, and that includes processing for meat, and it's, I think we need to be culturally sensitive and diverse in our willingness to accept various dietary habits, and to let a good horse go to waste and bury it in a backyard and let the worms eat it rather than let a human being eat it, I think is a real waste, especially in a hungry world like we're in. And there are certainly horses that are just plain mean and incorrigible, and I've owned some of them. That, as a matter of fact, I bought one from a veterinarian. It was so darn mean when I brought the killer buyer out to my farm to look at it. The horse attacked both of us. It ran at us with his mouth open and turned and tried to kick us. So it was a horse I thought that really deserved to be eaten.
One last question, Senator Godrey.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. But Senator Dill, your bill doesn't do any of that. I don't understand why we would spend all this time on a controversial topic in which I need more information. I hear what you're saying, I hear what the other side is saying, and for, you know, when maybe just you and a variety of like-minded legislators could just sign a letter and write it to Congress saying the same thing. We're spending a lot of time for what it's not going to do anything. I mean, if the bill was actually changing Minnesota law and it was important, then, and the bill actually had an impact, but wouldn't we just be better off instead of doing this in this committee and then, I don't know if it has another committee or on the floor, spending all that time, why don't just a variety of like-minded legislators on this issue just co-sign a letter to Congress? I do that all the time on issues rather than just doing a resolution.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, has this bill been moved yet?
Nope.
I would move that Senate File 133 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor.
Anybody understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
No.
So adopted. You're on your way. And this meeting is adjourned. Wow.